Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're going to have the privilege of speaking at length with one of our most important contributors. His name is Rabbi Pasek Wilicki. I find him to be one of the most thoughtful, clear-eyed, and courageous practitioners of the business of information warfare on behalf of his adopted homeland, Israel. He is an American who made Aliyah there some 30 years ago. He has, I believe, four children engaged in the Gaza operation at the moment, or have been to this point. He knows whereof he speaks, and he speaks with extreme clarity, and we're always delighted to have him with us. And I'm going to turn to him to respond to the Gaffney brief. South Africa is opening a new front in the war on the Jews by charging their only state, Israel, with genocide in Gaza, before the International Court of Justice. As it happens, that message will be amplified profoundly in Washington, D.C., where the Muslim Brotherhood and its Marxist allies will be on the streets of Washington, D.C. on Saturday to denounce, to vilify, and otherwise seek to advance their shared purpose, which is the destruction of the state of Israel. Unfortunately, these events are just the latest example of the kind of toxic anti-Semitism that is now abroad worldwide, in part inflamed by the pretext that Israel, after it was viciously invaded, has responded in a manner that deserves condemnation. But let's be honest, this is just a pretext. It is part and parcel of, I think, the general enmity that the Jews and their state unfortunately experience in too many places around the world, and now including, thanks to the Muslim Brotherhood and its friends here in America. This is all made the more outrageous because the group that is the beneficiary of the South African gambit and the Brotherhood and Marxists' attacks here and elsewhere around the world is a genocidal enterprise explicitly by its own charter. That would be Hamas, a designated terrorist organization that says explicitly it is about the destruction of Israel. And not least, we are seeing those who are on the streets of Washington and elsewhere championing the idea of ridding Israel from the river to the sea are similarly espousing what can only be described as genocide. I want to make this absolutely clear, and I'm sure that our friend Rabbi Wilicki will do as well. Those determined to exterminate the Jews are intent on doing exactly the same thing to Judeo-Christian civilization. That means they're after us as well. It also means we must stand with Israel as it fights our fight. That's the brief. Rabbi Wilicki, thank you so much for joining us. Fresh off the plane from Jerusalem, we are delighted to have you always, but especially, as the Bible says, at a time such as this. Thank you for your Shoulder to Shoulder podcast. Thank you for your many other contributions on both sides of the pond, including your visits with us from time to time here at Securing America. We're glad to have you back. I want to talk with you about this idea of Israel engaged in genocide, sir. You heard the brief. What are your thoughts?
Well, if Israel is engaged in genocide, then they're absolute failures at committing genocide. The claim is absurd on its face. First, let's make it clear. If Israel wanted to engage in genocide against the people of Gaza, then no Israeli soldiers would be dying, and this entire war would have been over in a couple of days. Israel is not engaged in any form of genocide. The concept, let's just break it down into numbers. Let's talk about civilian casualties, which is where this is coming from. And Secretary of State Blinken, yet again, just a couple of days ago on his latest visit to the Middle East, of course, called out Israel for a number of civilian casualties that is far too high. Now, that's a very devious thing to say, because it's the kind of thing that no one who is an ethical person should ever want to disagree with. Of course, all civilian casualties are tragedies, so calling civilian casualties too high sounds like one of these points that everyone could agree with. But the problem is that it's actually a very devious statement, because when we look at the rate of casualties in general, civilian casualties versus military casualties in this conflict versus other conflicts in the world, we see that Israel has actually caused, well, Israel hasn't caused, but the conflict has caused far less civilian casualties than most conflicts. According to the UN's own report of just a couple of years ago, the ratio of civilian casualties to military casualties in most conflicts in the world in the 20th century has been 9 to 1, meaning nine civilian casualties for every military death. Now, according to Hamas's own numbers, and the only numbers that are out there in the media for civilian casualties in the Gaza Strip in this conflict are coming from the Gazan Health Ministry, which is, of course, a Hamas entity. And those numbers shouldn't be trusted. However, that's the only numbers that are being quoted in the media, because the Israeli government, out of prudence, because we don't know how many civilians are killed in a conflict until the dust settles, has not put out their own number. And I think that's a mistake. I wish the Israelis would put out a number to counter the narrative. But let's just take the Hamas number on its face, Frank. Hamas claims, as of today, that about 23,000, just over 23,000 civilians have been killed. However, Hamas does not count ever in its casualty count the number of Hamas terrorists who've been killed. They never give out that number, as though none have been killed. They've never published a number. But the truth is that Hamas counts all the terrorist deaths, all the Hamas fighters. And we call them terrorists because they're terrorists, but I actually don't like calling them terrorists, Frank, and this is an important point. When we call them terrorists, it makes it sound like they're some rogue criminal operation, like a basement mafia, but they're not. They're actually the armed forces of the governing body of the Gaza Strip, which is the Muslim Brotherhood branch in Gaza. So they're actually an armed, they're more like the army of the Gazan population, but they never count them. They all wear civilian clothes in combat, which is, of course, a violation of international law. It's considered a war crime because it endangers civilians. But because they wear civilian clothing for a variety of reasons, one of the reasons they wear them is so that their deaths can be counted as civilian deaths. Now, up to this point, Israel maintains that they've killed about 10,000 of the Hamas fighters. So if we simply subtract that number of Hamas fighters from the 23,000 number that Hamas is claiming, and then we drop down the number a little bit for Hamas exaggeration, you do the math pretty simply, you realize that there's actually been a quite a low number of civilian casualties in this war.
Hold the thought. We're going to come right back on that point. Rabbi Pesach Walecki is in the house, giving us the truth about what's going on in Gaza, and we need more of it. We'll be right back for that purpose. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tomorrow, the Securities and Exchange Commission will stop taking comments on a proposed rule allowing so-called natural asset companies to raise funds to preclude the productive use of U.S. public and even some private lands, water, and even air. This stealthy effort to impose a radical environmental agenda must be strongly repudiated immediately. One reason is NACs can be owned by foreign powers, like the Chinese Communist Party, strategically motivated to lock up our natural resources. That's especially so if, as the then-Chinese defense minister declared 2 decades ago, the PRC leadership plans to use biological weapons to depopulate the United States so that it can be colonized by the Chinese. A further incentive would be if we have left untapped vast quantities of oil, gas, minerals, and timber. Please express your opposition to this dangerous NAC sell-off and sell-out today at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Rabbi Pesach Wilicki is in the house virtually. We're talking to him, having gotten him across the Atlantic recently. He's now going to spend a couple of days in Washington, I presume not at the Hamas rally in Washington, but we'll be talking more about that in a moment. Rabbi Wilicki is a very formidable contributor to, I think, the practice of Hasbara, I think is the term in Yiddish, talking about things we need to know truthfully and with great, great clarity. I admire him tremendously for that. You can find his work at, among other places, Israel 365 Action, and also his must-see podcast television program, Shoulder to Shoulder. And Rabbi, I understand that your most recent of those programs, Shoulder to Shoulder, is on point with respect to the topic that I'm anxious to get your thoughts on next, and that is the state of the war. You've I think, very helpfully described the degree to which Israel has exercised remarkable discipline and restraint, even at the expense of the lives of their own soldiers, to avoid harming civilians, densely packed on a good day in Gaza. And it's not a good day in Gaza. They're extremely densely packed in lots of places there. Talk to us a little bit, if you would, about how the campaign is going. We've been hearing about Israel changing strategy and withdrawing forces. Is that because the mission has been accomplished? Is it because the United States is compelling them to do so? What's the state of play in Gaza, as you understand it, sir?
Well, I'll say this. The United States pressure has not been helpful along the way. This war would have been over a lot quicker, would be over a lot quicker, if the United States was not pressuring Israel. Let me just drill down on that point before I answer your question more fully. People hear in the media about the U.S. pressuring Israel to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza. Now, most of the civilians in Gaza near the beginning of the war were evacuated to certain safe zones that are out of harm's way, where humanitarian aid was being provided anyway. What the United States has been pressuring Israel to do is allow humanitarian aid into northern Gaza and into central Gaza, into the same places where Israel is working to defeat Hamas. Now, that humanitarian aid is immediately commandeered by Hamas, who are still in control. And then most of that aid is brought down into the tunnel network and is used to sustain the Hamas fighters underground. Part of that humanity.
May I just ask, is that documented? I mean, is that something?
I mean, it's well known. No one denies it. It's indisputable. In fact, even in some of the Arab news outlets, they've reported it, because the civilians in who remain in those areas in Gaza have been outspoken about the fact that they can't get to the humanitarian aid because the Hamas leadership takes it all for themselves down into the tunnels.
Some, I even understand, have been shot by
Correct.
Hamas
yeah.
as they've tried
there's,
to get that aid.
There's been footage that's been out there of Hamas firing on civilians in Gaza who are trying to get at the aid. So the truth is that this that this quote-unquote humanitarian aid that Israel is being forced to allow into northern Gaza has prolonged the conflict. But when we talk about where we are now, like and all the things you hear about Israel moving to a different stage of the war, and it sounds like they're de-escalating as a result of American pressure, it's not exactly right. I've been pleasantly surprised at how well Israel's leadership has withstood American pressure when it comes to the military operation. The allowing in of humanitarian aid has been problematic and it's made things worse. And again, what's more humanitarian? If the war would end more quickly, there'd be less casualties and normal life could resume more quickly. So when people think that withholding humanitarian aid is actually the humanitarian thing to do, and that seems like a contradiction, it's really not. But in terms of what Israel's doing, Khan Yunis, which is the main city in southern Gaza, that and Rafah, which borders Egypt, that's where the Hamas leadership is, and that's the main command and control center of Hamas. The other main center of Hamas before the war
started. Is it fair to say underground?
Underground, yes. Yes, underground. We'll get to that in a moment. But in northern Gaza, in Gaza City, Jabalia, and the other what's called refugee camps, they're not really refugee camps. They were set up as refugee camps in the late 1940s and early 50s. These are refugee camps where there's villas and there's homes and there's shopping malls. They're not exactly refugee camps. That's what we call them. So those camps in the center of Gaza and northern Gaza, the way it was set up there, it made more sense to do large amounts of airstrikes and then move in on the ground, going house to house. And I'll point out that I heard from soldiers who were in combat. I'm not going to say which soldiers who were in combat, wink, wink to your introduction, but soldiers who were in combat told me that when they go building to building, literally every single building, and we're talking about Jabalia, Sajia, Gaza City, when they go building, literally every apartment building has multiple apartments in it that the soldiers found RPGs, AK-47s, missiles, yeah, rocket-propelled grenades, meaning there's arms storehouses in literally every apartment building. And this was done deliberately by Hamas. They basically weaponized the entire population. And if civilians refused to cooperate, then they'd be cut out of social services. That's the way it worked in Gaza. But basically, to answer your question about where we are, northern Gaza, it made more sense to do a lot of airstrikes and then move in on the ground. And in Khan Yunis, because it's really all about the underground operation, the airstrikes are not so effective. And therefore, Israel is pulling back from doing airstrikes and moving to more trying to root out the terrorists from their underground enclaves. Now, these underground enclaves are not, people think of the tunnels as, like they'll see a picture online of what looks like a subway tunnel, or they'll just think of it as like, one little tunnel. They have to understand these tunnels are more like underground buildings with multiple stories. There are elevators that go down and there are multiple levels. You can go down to first floor, second floor, third floor in the tunnel network. There's all kinds of different rooms. There's factories down there to make weapons, to make munitions more than weapons. These are very complex underground cities, as it were.
And again, at the risk of stating the obvious, this is on the basis now of firsthand inspection.
Correct.
By
correct.
Israeli forces that have gone in and liberated these.
The Israelis didn't even know how extensive the tunnel network was. The estimates at the beginning of the war, which already sounded outlandish, turned out to be understated. The underground network is almost covers the entire underground of these cities. So it's going to be very slow moving, but it's not going to require the type of airstrikes that were needed in northern Gaza. So Israel is what it is technically a de-escalation because they're using a different type of warfare. There is a complication now, which is that, in war, conquering land is easier than holding it once you've conquered it. And for Gaza City, for the northern part of Gaza, where Israel now is holding, is in control of this area, but you still have Hamas cells running around there. And now it's moving more towards guerrilla warfare, where Hamas is coming out of various points of hiding and there's more. The urban combat hasn't finished up there, even though Israel holds a lot of the positions. So much of Hamas's infrastructure has been destroyed. Many of their fighting forces have been dismantled. Also, lines of communication between the leaders of Hamas in Gaza and the leaders of Hamas who are outside of Gaza, sitting in Qatar and elsewhere, have broken down to a certain extent, we're being told. So Hamas is in a state of disarray. But let me point something out that's interesting that I just saw in the news as of today. I just saw this in the Israeli news today. How much time do we have till the next break, Frank? Okay, so we'll get to it after the next break.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back with more with Rabbi Pesach Walicki, walking us through what's actually happening in this war for Israel's survival. Let's be clear. And we've been talking about the Gaza phase of that war, critically important, very much still in play. And we'll find out how that play is going at the moment with Rabbi Walicki on the other side of the break. Please stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say we are continuing this really important, extremely topical conversation with Rabbi Pesach Walicki of Israel, and we're talking about some of the things that he's been recently covering in his own program, Shoulder to Shoulder, a very important podcast, the most recent of which is a report from an Israeli soldier who has been giving an update to him, and we're getting the benefit of his insights with Rabbi Walicki right now. And Rabbi, you were unfortunately interrupted as you were making an important point about Gaza. Let's finish that up.
Yeah, it was reported today that the Qataris had recommended an end to the conflict that would involve Hamas essentially surrendering and the Hamas leadership being allowed safe passage out of Gaza, but having to go into exile, meaning that the Hamas leaders who are on the run, who are in the tunnels, would be allowed to leave, but they would have to be sent into exile completely, and Hamas would no longer be in control down there. And Hamas rejected this as a possible end to the conflict. Now, let's keep in mind when we're looking at people who are screaming and yelling about all the civilian casualties, which are terrible, but they're all the fault of Hamas. The fact that Hamas refuses to surrender and give up governing control of Gaza in order to end the conflict shows how out of touch with reality they are, because it means that they still are under the belief, they're still under the assumption that when all is said and done, they will still be in power there. If you think about it, if they didn't have that confidence, they would certainly accept this deal, which means they think that they're going to still remain in power.
Let me just ask you this question. Do you credit this report? Is it authoritative that this is what the Qataris said? Because I must tell you, I'm astonished that the principal bankroller of Hamas. I mean, Iran's in the mix too, of course, but I think a fair amount of it's coming out of Qatar. And certainly the protection to the Hamas leadership that's in exile is Qatari's fault. This would be a very big deal.
It was reported in Ynet. Here it is. It was reported. I'll read to you right here. It was reported in Ynet. Ynet is one of the main Israeli news sources. It was reported here at 10 p.m. Israel time last night that there was a Qatari offer that all of the hostages would be released. There would be a full ceasefire, and it would involve all of the leadership of Hamas leaving Hamas. And Hamas denounced leaving Gaza, and Hamas denounced this as a Zionist plot that Qatar was now going to be complicit in, meaning they pushed back on this. But it just shows you how out of touch with reality is that they still believe that when the dust settles, they will be in control of Gaza.
But here's my thought on it, for what it's worth, Rabbi, and I'd like your reaction. Whatever Hamas thinks, if the Qataris are now saying this is the new baseline for an agreement to settle this matter, which is, let's face it, unconditional surrender, basically. Now, one can talk about the advisability of letting these guys go, because wherever they go, there'll be a problem, to be sure. But I want to say that would seem to change everything in terms of the whole dynamic here. I wonder whether this will be a feature of the march in Washington on Saturday.
I have no idea. It's interesting because the organizations that are funding the march are all really funded by Qatar. So, you know, it's interesting that this is what's being reported in Israeli media last night. Now, it doesn't mean that the Israelis accepted this offer, but when Qatar put out this offer, you know, because I don't know how the Israeli public would feel if it was decided to allow the architects of October 7th, who are hiding underground, to live. But if it meant getting all of the hostages back, they probably would accept it. But I think you're absolutely right. The fact that Qatar is pushing for a solution like this means that Qatar also realizes that Israel is resolute, that Hamas will no longer be in power. But Hamas
and more
is
to the point that it's
yeah,
winning.
Go ahead. More that it's winning, right, exactly.
And it's accomplishing the mission.
For sure.
So, Rabbi, we've got to move along because there's many other aspects to this we've also got to get, you know, your take on. But let me just say that if this means anything, it suggests that Israel will have, you know, a better basis for saying to the United States, among others, we've got this. We're working the problem, and it is moving in the right direction. You want this war to end on a basis that could be, you know, actually conducive to something approaching peace. Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about what it means, even if you extract these Hamas leaders from a population that is entirely aligned with them, just about, it seems. But at least it's a starting point for a very different Gaza, it seems. And I would say it's a hopeful thing. But Rabbi, if you want to comment on that, fine. But I do want to make sure we talk about
Let's move on.
The North. You mentioned that, and this perhaps would be Israel's approach to the you know, removal of these Hamas guys. It hasn't acknowledged responsibility, but I think it's pretty obvious that Israel decapitated one of the leaders of Hamas in Beirut. This has served as a new pretext for Hezbollah to up the attacks on Israel. 80,000 or so of your countrymen are now obliged to be outside of the zone up there. Mm-hmm. What's your take on the war there? And whether it is going to escalate, as they say here in Washington, endlessly.
Well, look, no one wants escalation in the north. The Israelis don't want it. And Hezbollah doesn't want it. So one might think that that's a pretty simple equation. If no one wants it, there shouldn't be escalation. But the problem is that Hezbollah, in violation of certain agreements that were made years ago, moved its armaments and its men very close to Israel's border. There's supposed to be a buffer zone that they violated. And Israel wants to make sure that they are far away enough from the Israeli border to not endanger Israeli towns. And therefore, there is an escalation. The escalation is a result of the fact that Hezbollah keeps firing rockets at Israeli civilian targets on a daily basis. We're getting rockets into Israel. It was just a few hours ago. You know, I'm constantly keeping up on the ticker coming out of the Israeli news. And even just in the last few hours today, there have been rocket attacks at Israeli towns in the north. And let's always remember, whenever we talk about this, that Israel gets criticized when, despite their best efforts, civilians get killed, and the enemies we're fighting always deliberately target civilians, and somehow they get a pass on the world stage. So Hezbollah continues to attack Israel and at the same time say they don't want escalation. Israel's demand is very simple. Either there's a diplomatic way to move Hezbollah 30 kilometers back from the border, but if there's no diplomatic move to do that, then Israel will take matters into our own hands and move Hezbollah back. So if it requires going to war with Hezbollah, we will. As Yoav Gallant, our defense minister, said last week, he said when we're done in Gaza, we will do to Gaza, and he used the expression cut and paste. He says we could cut and paste what we've done to Gaza to South Lebanon. Now, that's very interesting that he said that, because Israel's leadership is known for not telegraphing its next move. They're usually very prudent about that. And the fact that Yoav Gallant said this, telegraphing what's coming in the future, means that it was more of a warning than anything else. And Israel wants Hezbollah to know that one way or another, our northern border will be safe.
We have to get this next point across quickly because we have to take another break here shortly. But Rabbi, when you talk about moving Hezbollah 30 miles north, what is the logic of that? Is it to try to move or expose at least the vast array of missiles and rockets that they've stashed close by the border there? Is it that there's some strategic calculus that it'll be harder for them to launch attacks on Israel of other kinds, especially ground operations, if they're pushed back? And remind us of the legacy of this. There was a time when South Lebanon was, you know, in the hands of Christian militia that were supported by Israel. Regrettably, they gave that up. The Israelis pulled out and abandoned those Christian Lebanese, as I recall. Walk us through where you think this all fits together.
Well, some of it is topographical. The way the hills are there, if they're pushed 30, and it's 30 kilometers, if they're pushed 30 kilometers back from the line, it makes it much more difficult for them to hit civilian targets in Israel. It changes what... Because of the topography, because of the angle up to the hills and the Israeli towns. And that's an important strategic advantage. It also means that that incursions of terrorists of human threats are basically eliminated because it allows for so much surveillance and reaction from the Israeli side. I'm not sitting in the Situation Room, and I'm not a general in the Israeli army. And why they determined that it's 30 kilometers is what is gives enough enough room. Yeah, that gives enough of a buffer zone, because the main thing is to make sure that the people living in those northern communities feel safe. And as you said, one of the many mistakes that Israel has made, and unfortunately, all of the suffering that we're going through now, it is the result of policy mistakes by Israeli leadership over the last couple decades.
We're going to come back and talk a little bit about that on the other side of a break, and also the Houthi rebels. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Tomorrow, the Securities and Exchange Commission will stop taking comments on a proposed rule allowing so-called natural asset companies to raise funds to preclude the productive use of U.S. public and even some private lands, water, and even air. This stealthy effort to impose a radical environmental agenda must be strongly repudiated immediately. One reason is NACs can be owned by foreign powers, like the Chinese Communist Party, strategically motivated to lock up our natural resources. That's especially so if, as the then-Chinese defense minister declared 2 decades ago, the PRC leadership plans to use biological weapons to depopulate the United States so that it can be colonized by the Chinese. A further incentive would be if we have left untapped vast quantities of oil, gas, minerals, and timber. Please express your opposition to this dangerous NAC sell-off and sell-out today at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're finishing up our conversation shortly, and there's a lot more to cover with Rabbi Pesek Wilicki, covering the war in the Middle East at the moment, how Israel is faring and what it is accomplishing. And Rabbi, before we wrap this report up, we must talk about what another of Iran's proxies has been doing. And about Iran itself, for that matter, in all of this, notably not just firing occasionally missiles at Israel, but also their attacks against shipping with quite a significant impact on movement of, well, among other things, goods and material into the Israeli port of Eilat in the south. Walk us through what that looks like at the moment, the strategic challenge it poses to Israel, especially as it seems is beginning to have an effect on Israel's ports in the Mediterranean as well.
Yeah, let's first talk about why Iran even backs the Houthis. The Houthis, while they are sort of Shia, they're not really Shia. They're from another sect of Islam. They're an offshoot of Shia, but the real reason that the Iranians support the Houthis is because of their geographical location. The fact that the Houthis can control the mouth of the Red Sea that leads up to the Suez Canal, which is one of the main choke points. You know, there are 3 major choke points in the world for international shipping. There's the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, and the Straits of Malacca. And the Houthis control the entry point into the Red Sea, and that is of strategic importance to the Iranians, and that's why they support them. The Houthis are not really posing a threat to Israel, let's be honest. Because of their distance and because of the nature of the rockets that they're firing at Israel, they pretty much all get shot down. They're not going to cause any casualties. They're not an existential threat to Israel. What the Houthis are doing, and when we talk about what the Houthis are doing, what we mean is what the Iranians are doing. But what the Houthis are doing is trying to draw the United States into this conflict in a kinetic way. And the United States is now stuck at what chess players would call a fork, where you have to choose between 2 bad options. Because the United States has been snookered. Because what's happening now is that the Houthis continue to escalate their attacks. There have been dozens of attacks since mid-November on ships passing through that area. And the United States and its allies, especially the British, keep saying this is the last time, and one more of these, and we're gonna attack, and yet they're not attacking. All they're doing is shooting down the drones and shooting down the rockets. They have not actually retaliated against the Houthis at all. Now, if they don't retaliate, they look weak, which they do. If they do retaliate, they get drawn into a wider Mideastern war, which is exactly the game that the Houthis are playing. What exactly the U.S. should do, if I was advising them, I would say, you know, if we think back to Donald Trump being president of the United States and the Houthis were doing something like this in that part of the world, there would be significant airstrikes against Houthi targets, causing enough damage that they would think twice about doing this. But we also have to recognize that the Houthis are playing a domestic political game. When I say domestic, I don't just mean in Yemen, but I mean in the Arab world. The Houthis in September of this year, of this past year, in September 2023, the Houthis were facing a problem because they'd become the governing force for the most part in Yemen, or certainly in that region of Yemen, in the northwestern part of Yemen. And they were experiencing a lot of unrest because they weren't providing the civil services that they were supposed to be providing. And there were demonstrations all across Yemen against them. And as soon as October 7th happened, and then after that, the Houthis started firing various projectiles at Israel and saying that they were participating in the Israel-Hamas war, defending the Palestinians, according to their terminology. They immediately became admired by the same population that was protesting against them. And the rest of the Arab world has a harder time criticizing them because they're fighting against the Israelis. The Saudis are now afraid to get involved, because if the Saudis get involved against the Houthis, even though they've been traditionally opponents of the Houthis, if the Saudis were to oppose the Houthis at this point, they would look like they're defending Israel, which is a no-no in the Arab world. So by attacking Israel and by attacking American interests, the Houthis have made themselves more likable to the rest of the Arab world, to the rest of the Muslim world, and less open to criticism on that front. So there's a domestic agenda here as well.
So is that true of Iran as well? Are they now enjoying a surge of popularity in even the Sunni Arab?
I don't know how Iran is perceived in the Sunni Arab community, because there's such a long history of dislike there. But Iran is certainly poking the Americans. We just saw reports today that Iran seized an oil tanker. They claimed it was an American oil tanker. Now, it turns out it wasn't an American oil tanker, but that doesn't matter when it comes to the claim. If you think about why would the Iranians, who just seized an oil tanker, claim that it was an American oil tanker? They're trying to poke poke the Americans in the eye and essentially attack the Americans. They also, the Iranians recently moved some of their naval assets into the area where the Houthis are blocking the Red Sea. So they're down there as well. We should also remember that the Iranians have a naval presence in the Gulf of Mexico. The Iranians are very clear about their agenda to antagonize the United States. Yeah. And yet,
well,
the
actually
US
very
government...
clear about their agenda to destroy the United States.
Yeah. I mean,
death to Israel, death to America.
Right. And, Frank, it's worth noting the Houthis slogan, which is worn on an arm patch on every Houthi uniform. It has five statements in it. The Houthis slogan is, God is the greatest, meaning Allah is the greatest. Death to America, death to Israel, cursed be the Jews, victory to Islam. That's the five statements.
Pretty much says it all, doesn't it?
That's who they are.
And this brings us perfectly to where I want to go in the next conversation. You've really made the case, well, the patch has made the case, that this isn't just about the Jews. This is about the desire to destroy Judeo-Christian civilization, as I mentioned in my commentary. And if we don't understand that, and we don't realize that as a result, Israel is fighting our war as well as its own, we're not only missing the point, we're likely to make grievous strategic errors. We'll talk more about that. Stay tuned with Rabbi Walicki on the other side of the break. Welcome back to the final installment of this remarkably informative conversation with Rabbi Pesach Walicki of Shoulder to Shoulder podcast fame. Also, you can find his writings at Israel 365 Action. I commend both to you. Rabbi, we were just making the point that for the Iranians, for sure, for their various proxies. I would argue for Sharia supremacists of either the Sunni or Shia stripe. This is all about the war that they are called to under Sharia, the Islamic doctrine, to wage to, you know, make the entire world an Islamic caliphate under Sharia. Why is this so hard for us to understand? And is there any illusion based on what our enemies themselves say is the case?
That's a great question. Is there, you know, why don't people understand it better? You know, there are many who do. Let's just go, you know, you'll point out some things that should make us scratch our heads. The recently, over the Christmas season, there were pro-Hamas, anti-Israel demonstrations that took place all across the Western world, disrupting Christmas celebrations, right? The traditional performance.
Here too, by the way.
Yeah. At Rockefeller Center, when they were lighting the Christmas tree, there was a big anti-Israel riot that broke out. There was in London, the Christmas shopping was interrupted, deliberately saying there's no Christmas, without Palestine being free. All these things that are going on, and we saw this in Italy. The traditional performance at the La Scala Opera for Christmas was disrupted by anti-Israel demonstrators. But let's note, Frank, Israel is not a Christian nation. Israel is a Jewish nation that has a 2% Christian minority. So why would the enemies of Israel be disrupting Christmas celebrations as a way of being anti-Israel? But it's actually quite clear, and it's something that our side needs to fully understand, which is that our enemies do not see attacks on Israel and attacks on Christianity as separate. They view us as one camp. We are the camp that is Western civilization. We are the camp that is Judeo-Christian faith. We are the camp of biblical faith and traditional values, and they despise us. When we think about the absurdity of Queers for Palestine, and we like to laugh at them and groups like that, we have to understand that it makes perfect sense to their side. Those who despise Western civilization despise Jews and Christians alike. And that is what this is really about.
Yeah, and I believe that Queers for Palestine is among the sponsors of this march in Washington.
Oh, absolutely.
And will be much in evidence there. And this is such an important point, Rabbi. And it's, again, we don't, most of us, unfortunately, understand properly what is impelling the jihadis. And I would call that Sharia. But we also, I think, are overlooking or failing, even though they are pretty clear about it, among other things, through the list of, what is it, a couple hundred sponsors, who are Marxists, who are radical leftists, who are not Muslim at all, but are making common cause with the Brotherhood, precisely for the reason you mentioned, which is they both want the end of America and the end of Western civilization.
Yeah,
so this brings us to this point of how must those of us who love America, who love Israel, who love Western civilization and all that it has brought to the world, respond in this moment? Both, I'm thinking not only in terms of the international dimensions of it, but also, well, domestically. I mean, you've grown up in the United States, you know this country well. What are your recommendations here as well?
Well, my recommendations are to, you know, to see things clearly and to get off the bandwagon of calling for a ceasefire, get off the bandwagon of calling for a two-state solution, which is not a solution to anything, which would reward the terrorists, to get off that bandwagon.
Which would destroy Israel.
It would destroy Israel, but it's... We have to realize that, again, as you just said, we are in a global conflict between those who want to tear down Western civilization for all their various reasons, meaning the Chinese Communist Party and jihadist Muslims obviously don't share the same fundamental ideology, but they are partners right now and they are in league with each other right now. The UN Security Council resolution that passed the other day, condemning the Houthis for their attacks, there were four abstentions, The four abstentions were China, Russia, Algeria, and Mozambique. And these are, you know, China and Russia are not Muslim nations. Why would they veto a resolution condemning the Houthis for attacking international shipping? Because the Chinese and their allies, the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians, this is all one axis of evil. These are the people who want to take down Western civilization, and Israel's on the front lines. I'll say this about the march in Washington, Frank. This is something that Americans need to understand. These anti-Israel marches in places like Washington and London, these are victory parades. This is the enemy walking through the streets of the Western cities and basically saying, we're here, we've taken over. And if you look at polling about what young people believe, if you look at what's going on college campuses, they know that they have won without firing a shot. And Israel is a bone in their craw. Israel's right in the middle of the Middle East and is a Western nation, a Bible-believing nation, a capitalist success, all the things that Marxists and Sharia supremacist Muslims hate. And Americans have to realize that Israel's on the front lines. Our enemies have a slogan that appears on a lot of their flags that says, first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people. That's what their goal is.
Let me conclude with a takeaway, if I can. Frank's footnote, if you will. This little pamphlet, very thin, very easily read. It's available for free at securefreedom.org. It's titled The Explanatory Memorandum. It is the Muslim Brotherhood playbook for what they seek to do. And under section 4, point 4, I believe it is, in this book, it is clear that the mission of the Muslim Brotherhood, by its own words, is, quote, destroying Western civilization from within by their hands, meaning ours, and the hands of the believers. Make no mistake about it. That's the end game. Rabbi Pesach Walecki, thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back next time, and that until then, you will go forth and multiply.